This is Radioactive, a weekly grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for December 5th, 2013. This is Meredith DeFrancesco. Today we look at last week's elections in Honduras, riddled with numerous observed instances of election fraud and proceeding and continuing violence against Libre Party supporters and social movement activists. We also go to Ellsworth for a rally today in support of a wage increase for fast food workers. 100 cities across the country are slated to have worker strikes, and 100 more cities, including Ellsworth, are holding support rallies. More than 20 activists supporting the Libre Party in Honduras were murdered in the year and a half lead up to the elections last week. Many were also part of social movement organizations. On November 23rd alone, three members of a cooperative affiliated with a national farm workers organization were murdered. Though there are numerous accounts of election fraud, the EU has recognized the results, as has the US. The National Party, who spearheaded the 2009 coup, have been named victorious. Today we speak with Graham Russell, the director of the organization Rights Action. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So we want to talk about the repression and election fraud in Honduras. First, let's talk about it since the 2009 coup. Remind listeners the recent history of the 2009 military coup and the violence and repression that has been visited upon the Honduran people up until and including now, which has been reminiscent of the Central American violence in the 1980s. And then we'll get to the current election. But just kind of give us some of this real recent background.
Yeah, unfortunately, thanks for having me on the program. Honduras is, since the June 2009 coup, has taken a massive step backwards towards seeing once again levels of oppression that are similar to what was happening in Honduras in the 1980s. Honduran people are now living through levels of violence, generalized murder. They're the highest levels they've ever had and are the highest levels in the world in any country that's not at war. And the levels of poverty have once again spiked to historic levels, and all of this since the coup in 2009. And so just briefly to go back, it's not that Honduras was some sort of perfect democracy before the military coup. It was clearly a weak democracy. And it had one of the traditional oligarchy-dominated parties in power. But that party was taking small steps in the right direction, raising the horribly low minimum wage to just low, and bringing about other minor reforms. And even these minor reforms in 2008 and 2009 were not acceptable to the different elite sectors that conspired to carry out the coup. And basically, in mid-2009, the hierarchy of the military, the economic elites, the two dominant political parties, and the Catholic Church conspired to carry out a coup. And the coup itself was bloodless on June 28th, 2009, but everything else has been bloody since then. The levels of repression have spiked to levels similar to the early 1980s. Hundreds of people have been the victims of targeted killings since the coup in 2009, and that has been continuous over the past 4 years, and it is once again spiked leading up to these elections that just occurred last weekend. And then, as I said, the levels of violence in the society as a whole. Honduras always had a fairly high murder rate per 100,000 population, if you compared it to Canada or Cuba or even the United States. And its murder rate per 100,000 population is now the highest in the world in non-conflict countries like, not including countries like Iraq or Afghanistan, for example. And so it's just been a devastating deterioration of all indices of what a healthy society might look like. And through all this, there's been an extraordinary popular movement. There's ongoing outright rejection of the coup in 2009, of the post-coup regime that's in power, that's backed by the military. And now there's been these fraudulent elections that have been marred by very serious repression. And unfortunately, I think these elections have been stolen from the Honduran people again. And it's going to remain a very hard and difficult situation in Honduras in the near future. And the only bright light, and I feel somewhat glum even saying this, is the amazing people's movement that are not going to accept this. They're going to suffer a lot, but they're going to continue to peacefully reject the outcome of these elections and the illegitimate regime that's in power.
Can you talk more about that social movement and how it has sustained since 2009?
I'm not sure how it sustained itself. I know how it came together through my work with Rights Action. I was in Honduras with fact-finding missions and journalists, etc., many times in 2009 and through 2010. And I was witness to the massive outpouring of hundreds of thousands of people in these daily marches. Some of the marches reached over 1 million people, it's estimated. And what happened was that it wasn't just the traditional sort of activist sectors like campesino movements, unions, teacher movements, and the like that came out to protest the coup in 2009. Most of Honduras came out to protest it because they're so sick and tired of the country being dominated by a greedy and repressive elites. And they saw that that's what happened with the coup in 2009 one more time. And all of this sort of supported and legitimized by Canada and the United States. And so in the marches on the streets, there was grandparents and grandchildren and mothers and daughters and children and high school students and their marching bands and universities and their marching bands. It was a massive and sort of a glorious outpouring of democratic participation and rejection of the coup. Unfortunately, the only response the regime could give was repression. And that is the only response that this regime will give to its own people and their outpouring of sort of activism and democratic expression, and that's repression. So it came together very organically in 2009 and 2010. How it sustained itself is a more complicated story because the levels of repression and targeted assassinations have been very high. And yet through all that, grassroots organizations all across the country have maintained their unity and their activism. And then it once again coalesced in 2012 and 13 when out of this popular movement, a new political party was formed called Libre, which is the Party for Liberty and Refoundation. And that was a party that clearly would have won elections were they held in a free and fair way. But as I said at the outset, all through 2013, there was levels of killings and attacks against Libre members spiked. And then there was outright fraud in the days before and during the actual election.
Yeah, let's get into more detail, if you can, about the fraud that was observed and these last set of elections.
Yeah, there's very concrete things. But again, to set the stage, the real problem with the elections is the last 4 years of impunity and corruption. And that for all these hundreds of killings that occurred, no justice has been done. And then through 2013, at least 18 Libre-affiliated people were the victims of targeted killings. No justice was done for those killings whatsoever. So even before Election Day, there was serious repression against the Libre Party because the traditional parties, mainly the National Party, that's supported by much of the oligarchy, they knew what was going on in the country. They knew that Libre had a massive groundswell movement behind it. So they used as a part of their election toolkit, they used direct repression against Libre. They were intimidating people. They outspent Libre by numbers of anywhere from $20 to $50 to $1 because they have all the money on their side. They own most of the media. So all of these are the pre-election day factors that stack the deck in favor of the National Party. And then there was dozens of North American, Canadian and American election observer missions in Guatemala, as well as the European Union and other observer missions. And what came up from across the country was a series of repeated allegations that in many different parts of the country, firstly, there was many testimonies of people who showed up to vote but could not vote because they were apparently dead. They showed up on voting lists as being dead when they were actually alive. Secondly, what was repeated was that many dead people voted. So in the final tallies, it showed up that so-and-so had voted, but then the family members would come forward and say, well, that so-and-so died years ago. So that is his classic, simple fraud. Another area of fraud was that when there's elections, at each election table, all political parties have the right to have a political party member there overseeing the vote and observing for any irregularities. And many of the small parties sold their rights to be present at the tables to the National Party. So the National Party was buying election worker credentials from the smaller parties, and so they were stacking each of the tables with National Party members. Thirdly, and a massive thing, is that roughly speaking, 20% of the tally sheets are alleged to have been diverted to an illegal server. And how this is showing up is that the Libre Party was able to salvage almost all of the tally sheets. They've lost some 1,500 of them, but they've maintained somewhere around 14,500 of them. Their tally sheets differ significantly from the final tally sheets that were published by the Supreme Electoral Tribunal when it published the results. Hmm. And there's discrepancies of up to 130,000, 140,000 votes between the National Party and the Libre Party, which would make a significant swing in just the official votes. So there's an ongoing list of irregularities like that occurred on Election Day, all of that in the context of the repression against the Libre Party.
And were there not allegations of individual votes being paid for?
Oh, yeah, and photographs of this from different sites around the country. People would disappear around the back of a house, a voting building, and come back out with a bag. And there was a National Party truck set up behind that was giving people bags of whatever they had inside them, so paying them off with goodies. And all they would take is their proof of voting. And some people were taking cell phone camera shots of their vote for the National Party to then go and get their bag of goodies from the National Party. These are all the small things that were documented over and over and over again.
So talk a little bit more about the role of international observers who have documented these situations
of
fraud.
Where that's really blown open is with the European Union's observer mission. Mm-hmm. And one member, the European Union's official observer mission officially gave the elections a stamp of approval. And this flies in the face of electoral findings from dozens of North American groups that were spread across the country and were officially recognized as observer missions. These weren't just people who showed up and self-declared themselves observer missions. They got official credentials from the Supreme Electoral Council, et cetera, mm-hmm. and spread out across the country. The European Union official body ended up endorsing the elections, but one member broke off and said that that many members of the European Union's electoral team simply do not agree with the conclusions that were published, and they had huge internal dissent. And so one member has come out publicly and denounced what the European Union's conclusions were, and then himself laid out all of the irregularities that you and I have just talked about and said that these were all irregularities that were confirmed by different members of the European Union's mission.
You are listening to Radioactive on WERU-FM. We are speaking with Graham Russell of Rights Action about the election last week in Honduras, which many legal observers say was fraudulent. Violence against social movement activists has been continuous since the 2009 military coup and intensified against supporters of the Libre Party preceding the election. Can you talk about the U.S. and Canada's reaction to this election?
The U.S. government has endorsed it, not surprisingly, and very unfortunately, but not surprisingly. I have not heard of an official response from the Canadian government. I have no doubt the Canadian government will as well officially endorse this election. Both the Canadian and U.S. governments have had, I think, in sort of non-political terms, have blood on their hands for what they've done in Honduras since the coup in 2009 by legitimizing the very repressive regime that's in power and doing extensive business with the regime in power since the coup in 2009. So I don't know the official Canadian response. The official American response is that they are endorsing the election, saying that they were free and fair.
And what's the extensive business? Do you want to elaborate on that?
Well, the U.S. is the number one power in Honduras going back well over 100 years. And the early United Fruit Company and the banana company Barons and the train companies all made some of their early fortunes in Honduras, particularly in the northern region along the north coast. So the U.S. has been the dominant economic player in Honduras since then and remains so today. I think some 70% of Honduran foreign business deals directly with the United States. So the United States is the elephant in the room, and that's the beginning and the end of the story. Where there's been a significant increase in Canadian business interest in Honduras is through mining. Canada has sweatshops like Americans do and other countries do in Honduras. There's a huge and booming sweatshop industry because of very underpaid workers in many American and Canadian brand name companies. There's a booming tourism industry along the north coast, and it's attracting investors from Canada, Italy, from the Inter-American Development Bank, and they're forcibly evicting indigenous Garifuna people from their lands. So those are smaller but growing business areas. But the major growing business area, certainly for Canada, is the mining industry. And over 30% of Honduras' landmass has been concessioned out to mainly Canadian mining companies. There's been a moratorium on mining since before the coup against President Zelaya in 2009. And it was probably one of the decisions he took that led to the coup, because he put a moratorium on open-pit mining. And one of the Canadian mining giants in Honduras is called Goldcorp, and it operated a huge cyanide leaching open pit mine in Honduras all through the 2000s, and there's widely documented health and environmental harms. President Zelaya, before he was ousted, put a moratorium on giving out more mining concessions, and he said that a new mining law would seriously consider banning open-pit cyanide leaching mining. But none of that came to pass because he was ousted in the coup. And so the mining industry has been chomping at the bit to start mining there again. Since the coup, first thing that the Canadian government did was our prime minister went down and signed a free trade agreement with President Pepe Lobo, which was an awful and terrible thing to do on all fronts. And then secondly, Canada's aid agency, CETA, which is similar to USAID, funded the actual reform of the mining law in Honduras that was recently passed in this military-backed Congress. That's a law that's utterly favorable to the global resource extraction industry. So I think the mining industry is now just going to let the dust settle from these fraudulent, violent elections and then hopefully start mining widely across the country.
Can you talk a little more about who has been proclaimed the winner of these elections? And then you've been touching upon it the whole interview, but talk more concretely about what we're seeing as the opposition and social movement reaction and the fears that they have with this new president.
Well, the new so-called president declared is Juan Orlando Hernandez. And he's been the head of the Congress. He was a major player in the coup in 2009. What happened in 2009 is that they ousted the president at gunpoint and took him to Costa Rica illegally. They kidnapped him at gunpoint and forced him out of the country. And a forged letter was submitted to Congress. Everyone in Congress knew what happened, but they all endorsed this forged letter, and the letter said, "Hi, I'm President Zelaya. I resign for personal reasons. Goodbye." It was an absolutely forged letter. And President Zelaya was in Costa Rica at the same time in a press conference saying, "I was ousted at gunpoint. This is not true." The Congress endorsed it. They accepted it as a bona fide illegal document. They all should have lost their jobs for endorsing the illegal coup, and yet they all endorsed it and supported it. And Juan Orlando Hernandez, I think that's his name, who's now the head of the National Party, he was a major player in that. And then he's been the head of the Congress. He's been the president of the Congress since then. And in my view, this is an illegitimate and Congress that's rubber-stamped 4 years of repression and impunity. And then he oversaw the electoral campaign of the National Party that's allegedly won the elections. So no one expects anything positive to come from him as president. I still have a tiny hope that the elections will be overturned, but I suspect, honestly, that that won't happen.
Go ahead.
And so they will be accepted, and it'll be widely recognized as an illegitimate government, or Hernandez will take power in January, and it'll be contested by street protests and by the Libre Party, by Canada and the United States, particularly the United States being the main player in all of this. They'll accept it, and life will get back to a very repressive norm. But there are two silver linings in all this, is that the Libre even with the fraudulent elections, has come out by far as the second most powerful party, even with the illegitimate, the fraudulent vote count. And they're going to have a huge number of seats in Congress. And they're going to be able to a certain extent, shift the playing field in that corrupted Congress. And then secondly, the grassroots movement will remain empowered. It's daunting because they deserve to have won these elections with Libre, but now they have to probably suffer through at least another 4 years of quite serious repression. There are death squads operating in Honduras, both operated by state forces and by private landowners. That's not going to go down. That's not going to end anytime soon. So that's pretty exhausting for people who have struggled peacefully for so long. But I don't think that they are going to be cowed by this. They will suffer a lot, but they won't be cowed by this.
Graham Russell, anything else that you want to add about the elections, the repression, the election fraud, or anything else about the state of Honduras today?
Well, I just think that American listeners, like Canadian listeners, this is our story. This is once again the result of the only reason that the coup occurred in 2009, or a significant reason that the coup happened in 2009, has to do with Canadian and U.S. policies and the role we played legitimizing the post-coup regime. And likewise with these elections, if this president is allowed to take power in January, it'll probably most likely be because it gets backed and endorsed by Canada and the United States, which means that what happens in Honduras is partially our responsibility. And I think it's the onus is on American and Canadians to continually bring to the attention of our media and our politicians what is happening in Honduras, because part of it is on us.
Graham Russell with Rights Action, thanks very much for joining us today and speaking with us about this very important issue in our world.
Thank you very much.
Today, fast food workers in 100 cities are walking off the job in a one-day strike for higher wages. Supporting rallies were expected in close to 100 more cities, including Ellsworth. A year after their first strike, fast food workers in New York City will walk off the job. CBS Detroit reports hundreds of fast food workers will walk off the job in Michigan, already 100 reported at two McDonald's sites in Detroit. At 1 p.m. today, over a dozen demonstrators rallied outside the McDonald's in Ellsworth, many who had been present at the Walmart protest on Black Friday, where over 40 people demonstrated inside and on the street for higher wages and the right to organize.
Hi, I'm Irene. Part of why I'm here is because there's a myth in this country that the majority of fast food workers are, you know, are high school students or first job people. And the reality is, with the loss of jobs, a large number of people who had middle income jobs are now, because there are no jobs, forced to work for minimum wages. And The people that are working for minimum wages are older people and families and people of all ages, and none of them can survive on the minimum wage. So it's time to consider raising the minimum wage, which hasn't been raised in ages. And also, you know, isn't a livable wage.
Yes, we came out because around the country today there are fast food strikes in over 100 cities in the country, and we wanted Ellsworth to be included in that mix. And we're happy to support workers who are demanding an improvement in their wages and working conditions. And we're greatly encouraged by the incoming mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, who has said just recently that fast food workers deserve the right to organize so they can feed a family and not leave taxpayers footing the bill. And that is exactly why we're out here. And I think to now have like the mayor of the largest, or the incoming mayor of the largest city in the country, advocating for this is really a wonderful thing. And I hope our elected officials begin to think about this issue and maybe come up with a statement in support of the workers who don't really make enough to live on. I mean, that's the whole question. It's not about greed. It's sort of reverse greed. If you don't make enough to live on, someone has to help you. And I am all for helping people that can't make it. But McDonald's can help them better. They can help them a lot better, because McDonald's and the other fast food restaurants are lavishly profitable, lavishly. And they should be paying a living wage, so taxpayers don't really have to make up the difference. John Curtis, I'm a retired letter carrier and a member of the National Association of Letter Carriers.
So again, we're covering a similar action as we did at Black Friday and Walmart, focusing again on bringing up wages. Today is the fast food strike. Do you want to talk about the significance today?
52% of the people that work for fast food have got to be on some kind of a help, either food stamps or health care. They don't make enough to cover that, which costs the taxpayers $7 billion. If they were paid right on $15, they could manage a living life to be able to cover what their needs are, and plus a little bit more. And everybody should have enough to eat, to have a place to live, to stay warm, and to have health care. Slow but sure, we're growing. And I think over the whole country, I think you're seeing the movement gain momentum. I think people are sick of CEOs. The McDonald's CEOs just bought a second jet. And that doesn't make sense. When people are hungry and they don't have enough to live on, it just doesn't make any sense at all. If people want to join us, we have Facebook now, and we're on as Ellsworth Community Union.
And for those who don't have Facebook,
they're always on. They can call either John or myself, Ann Roberts. And I'm 669-2662. And John's, I'm not sure. Check with him, but he's up for giving it out too. We have meetings once a month, and the next one's going to be the first Tuesday in January. And that's going to be at 2 o'clock, and it's at Dunkin' Donuts. Come have a cup of coffee with us and visit with us
in Ellsworth.
Lauren Snow.
Well, I think it's way overdue, you know, and I think it's a shame, because these people working in these places like this and getting minimum wage and short hours, that they're costing, people don't realize what it's costing your communities a lot of money. Because what it actually does, these people have no health insurance or anything like that. They have to go on taxpayers' programs to try to make ends meet. So a lot of people who say, they just work at McDonald's, they don't realize they're paying for that in taxes. And if these people were getting a decent wage, they don't want to go on these programs. They're doing it to survive. And I bet you go in here, just like if you go in Walmart, and you'd find that the majority of them people are holding down 2-3 of these part-time jobs, minimum wage, to try to make ends meet.
And you've been listening to Radioactive, a weekly environmental and social justice news journal on WERU Community Radio. You can listen to archives of this and other locally produced public affairs programming at weru.org.